Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Danielle, are the markets bottoming out, and is there a process if they are?
Yeah, there's a process for sure. And if we look back on the last, basically recessionary bear markets are kind of a extreme category of their own. And I think that's what we're dealing with this time. You know, there are the odd time you get a bear market without a recession, and those tend to be more shallow. So a decline in markets of 20% that doesn't come with a recession in the overall economy tend to be milder and not very long lasting in terms of recovery in asset prices. But when you have it coupled with a downturn in the overall economy, you get more longer, durable, and deep declines in asset prices, and it takes many years to recover. So I think that's the brand we're in now, which would be akin to the kind of bear markets we saw in the 2007-9 cycle, the 2002-03 cycle, the 73-74 cycle, and the 69-70. So those were all sort of in the last, 50 years, the worst bear markets that came with recessions. And during those periods, it's very common, all the hallmarks of the top are very classically what we saw this cycle when, you had mass euphoria, mass speculation, people levering up, people making more on asset gains than they were in their jobs, people quitting their jobs to trade or, flip properties or do all this kind of thing, thinking that they were having great skill in the matter, when in fact it's just a function of, a bubble where a lot of liquidity sloshes around, drives prices up. So anyway, when you get all those hallmarks of a top, which were all present in the other cycles that I mentioned, then you get sort of the first leg down typically from the all-time high in the stock prices, and it can last, like 10, 15, 20, 30 trading days, and they can be typically in the 8 to 10% range, and it's very common for people to then start buying the dip again because the behavior is still very much entrenched in the gambling mode of the population. And so that type of thing usually leads to a rally again, but to a lower low, right? And then another leg down to a deeper low than the first leg. And so it goes. So if you look back, we've had a series of sort of 8 to 13 of those rallies within those cyclical bear markets that came with recessions over the years. And right now, we've sort of just come off the fourth. If it's ended, I'm just waiting to see. It's hard to tell. The stock market has increased significantly off the bottom that it reached in June, but it's up about 7% overall, 7 or 8% in terms of the S&P. But when you look under the hood again about what was really pulling that, it was the most shorted names. So the 50 stocks that were the most shorted, so those are the ones that people thought were the most egregiously overvalued and vulnerable in a bear market. So they were selling them short, and as they were falling, they were making money on those trades. Well, at some point, they blink and say, hey, we've made quite a bit. Let's book those profits. That means they have to buy the stocks back. And that's a feature, again, of these type of bear market environments. So you see these big rally days, and again, they typically last, they can last anything from a few days to a month even, and range anywhere from sort of 8% to 20%. We actually saw some rally in the 2000, 2003 cycle that were, you know, upwards of 15%. And in the 2008 cycle, we saw some that were, as you know, 16% and lasted up to 46 days. So they can be quite significant. And it's why they tend to sucker people back in, because, you know, they think, oh, well, obviously the coast is clear, let's go back and, you know, lever up again or buy anything that they have cash left. They sort of push that in, or if they had sold any in fear while things were dropping, they think, oh, we better go back in. So this kind of buy the dip mentality really persists for some time. And I'm just pointing out that, you know, again, we're very early into the decline this cycle. We had a peak to trough loss in the S&P of just over 20%, you know, less than the TSX. But we've got a lot of the leading sectors like the Russell, the small cap stocks, the NASDAQ, those things down more towards 30% before this latest bounce. And the commodities, a lot of the commodities, which are, again, that link with the global growth story and whether we're heading into a recession, those things, some of the key staples are off, you know, 20 to 40%. So those all suggest that we're really just getting started here in terms of the down cycle we could see. Traditionally, in this kind of environment, when you're starting from, again, these really extreme overpriced levels, with the amount of speculation, you get, in a recession, you get a bear market decline more in the area of 50%. So again, if we're off maybe 20, you're maybe halfway through if you're lucky. And we still have an awful lot of margin debt outstanding, as an example. I put a chart of that on the blog today. But, you know, again, we when we look back at this time in history, Jim, I think we're just going to be amazed at what a standout case it was for extremity, because even the margin abuse, which is people borrowing against their portfolio of stocks to buy more exposure, right, that amount of leverage has never been higher in human history than it was at the peak in 2021, late 2021. And so we've come off something like 20% in that margin. Because again, as prices fall, people get margin calls, right? They have to sell some of their securities to pay down the debt that they owe because they have to maintain a certain ratio. And so it forces selling on the way down. So as the S&P came off 20%, margins come off about that much. But if you look at the long-term chart, you can see that we're still so far above anything that was considered frothy or toppy in the past. And, you know, we could easily see it halve from here before you get back to even, you know, sort of a normal outcome of past cycles.
Are corporations and people who borrowed stacks of cash at cheap rates going to regret it?
Well, I think a lot of them already are regretting it. There's been an awful lot of negative sentiment building in the suddenly and dramatically in the housing market, for example, because, you know, it's been such a shock to the system. I mean, it really can't be understated. The Bank of Canada, when it raised by 1% on July the 13th in terms of the policy rate, have moved in 4 months' time, just since March, from a 0.25 base rate in the banking system to 2.5. That's a shock of magnitude that we haven't seen in many, many decades. So, you know, Canadian prime rate's about 4.7 and HELOC's about 5.2, and, you know, fixed rate mortgages of around 5% for a 5-year, 7% if you have to meet the stress test. This is all really a massive shift. And of course, it's caught many people offside because they were, you know, taking too much risk with too much leverage when prices were extremely high. They were presuming that things would stay, you know, that the Bank of Canada wouldn't raise rates for a very long period of time. And so it's really caught a lot of people off guard, and you're seeing that in all sorts of, you know, like the volume of mortgages clearly is off dramatically in both Canada and the U.S. because people can't qualify anymore. You know, if you look at back again, the last time that people were trying to qualify for a 7% mortgage, again, that's the stress test level if you're trying to get a fixed rate these days. That level in Canada was back in 2000 when the average median house price was about $164,000, and of course in February of 22 it was $816,000. So there's just an incredible amount of froth that has to come out of pricing before the regular person or even a, you know, a person with a good job can afford housing in this market. And many people who were buying properties as investments with very barely positive cash flow because they were paying too much before rates rose are now in a deeply negative scenario. So what you're seeing is that they are looking to either increase rents, which is a major pressure for buildings that aren't rent controlled. Landlords where possible are trying to, you know, spike rents to offset this dramatically higher mortgage rate scenario, and it's also causing people to list properties. So we're seeing this pickup in volume supply and a drop in buyers. So those two things typically will, you know, generally speaking, we should expect that to continue for some time here, and that will mean revert the prices back towards more normal ranges with respect to income and with respect to rents. So I think those people that bought in the last couple of years, or bought in even in the last few years with a lot of leverage are going to be struggling and looking to lower their exposure. So that's a painful adjustment on many levels, as well as for the economy, because we've become so dependent upon housing as a driver of growth, and not just here, by the way, of course, China being one of the poster children for this type of thing. In the past decade, they've really doubled down on housing as a way to promote their economic growth, and you're seeing the wheels really come off over there, right, where housing has been falling, and, you know, some 65 or 70% of household net worth in China is dependent upon whether they have equity in their primary residence, many of which they were buying, you know, family members pool resources to buy these assets, thinking it's the only way they're going to make any sort of savings, and sometimes can't even afford to live in the properties, but are trying to rent them out just in the assumption that, you know, prices will go up. Well, if prices are coming down, and they have been for over a year in China, people are starting to see that their equity has evaporated already, and their incentive to continue making their mortgage payments is gone. So right away, they're having all sorts of revolts of people not paying their mortgages, and it's kind of rolling back downhill. Now suppliers, so developers are not able to make their payments or continue their projects when they're not being paid by people looking to buy their units. And then you've got suppliers now revoking on their payments and not making deliveries, because they're not getting paid from developers. So it's really trickling downhill and causing a lot of discord and upset in the Chinese economy. And of course, there's a connection there with Canada, right? Not only on the commodities front in terms of our exports and the things that we try and sell to pay for everything else in our country, but also with respect to the inflows we were seeing for a long time with respect to Chinese investors coming into Canada and the Canadian real estate market, which we know has been understated to a large degree. As this goes on, we're seeing more of that come to light. So I think it's really crimping that cash flow at the same time that our domestic buyers are being hurt or unable to continue to consume housing at the pace they were doing. And then, of course, the other thing is that all of these incentives over the years, both on the fiscal side through CMHC backing, through governments allowing us to have the personal residence exemption, between policymakers trying to constantly drive rates low on the notion that low rates help consumers. Well, actually, what the studies confirm is that low rates actually help people get into more debt and help housing become more expensive so that people have to take on more debt to have it. So the Bank of Canada had already acknowledged this in research last year. It's been quite evident to many of us for a long time. But also what it's done is it's attracted too much capital into housing as a sector and to housing activity as a pursuit and away from other more productive things that we should have been doing with the money. And so really, it's costing us a lot in terms of the weight of that over time, because we've just got too inefficient. And again, I put on the blog today as well that, you know, the Bank of Montreal has come out with a study and report showing that, in fact, housing completions have outpaced household formation growth in Canada since 2000. So we have a lot more housing. You know, that whole idea that prices are too expensive because we don't have enough supply has actually not been true for the last 20 years. And we have a lot more housing units than we have households' ability to buy them. And no, immigration can't save us because, you know, even if we can reach our 400,000 annual goal of people coming in, those people are not going to be able to immediately step into, you know, buying up brand new homes, especially at the prices. Many of them are just trying to get a foot in, get started, get a job, you know, start becoming taxpayers, consumers, and then eventually investors. So there's a big disconnect there. So I think, and again, we're not the only country that has this problem. The U.S. is seeing the same kind of problems continue to roll out in their housing market. Of course, their average home price is half of what ours is. So, you know, it just underlines, again, how far ahead Canada is in this debacle of housing bubble.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Today, the Bank of Europe, or the European Central Bank, raised interest rates. First time in 11 years, the Bank of Japan didn't raise rates. I think they're the only major central bank that hasn't raised rates recently. But with the EU raising rates, what kind of an impact is that going to have on currencies?
Well, they basically, we've already seen this over the past several months where the U.S. dollar weighted index, which is a basket of currencies, the U.S. dollar against a basket of trading partners, had risen to the highest level in 20 years and to above 108 as against the basket, and the main component of that being the euro. So the U.S. dollar was trading at parity with the euro as of last week and is slightly, the euro has slightly strengthened on this, you know, first hike in 11 years by the ECB, where they are now at zero, Jim. They were negative in terms of their policy base rate in the banking system for the past many years, and with a 0.5 increase, they are now to zero. So, you know, hardly anything to write home about, but they were basically required to do that because what's happening is, of course, it's causing, it's making the inflation worse for European countries where they have to import anything based in U.S. dollars, things like energy, for example. When the euro has fallen so dramatically, a number of years ago, it was basically almost at 2-1 to the U.S. dollar. So it was overvalued then, but now it's fallen so dramatically and quickly in the past several months that it's making the cost push inflation in the European economy that much worse. And so they're having a lot of strife, obviously. There's a major recession coming in there as well in terms of a contracting economy. And Germany, the strong house of the European economy, is having its own strife and struggles, both with the Ukraine invasion constraints on their oil and gas, as well as problems in their housing market, which they didn't have in the last cycle, but the free money, you know, contagion has really impacted all sorts of housing markets around the world. So, to make a long story short, what it's doing is, this really strong dollar means that it means that the value of exports for these countries are less because when they're the value of them is less in terms of their home currency, as well as it leads to wider trade deficits because their imports are that much higher because, again, anything coming in U.S. dollars is going to be a lot more expensive for them. So it's really making wreaking havoc on their financial situation at a time when things are already frail. Everyone's basically looking to exports in the hopes they can find strong demand from somewhere because the domestic economies are flagging. And so it's causing a lot of strife. The other thing is that a really strong U.S. dollar, some 30 to 40% of U.S. large cap companies, that sort of what the world thinks of as the leading corporations in the world, some 30 to 40% of their revenue comes from sales overseas. So whenever you've got this kind of strength in the U.S. dollar, you really start to see a big hit to the earnings per share growth for those large corporations. In fact, some studies have shown that every 1% increase in the dollar index is a 0.5 loss to earnings per share growth. So a leap of 16%, like we've seen in the U.S. dollar index over the last year, equates to a negative 8% in terms of the earnings per share, just on currency alone. So here's the other reason why I think we're only just started into this bear market. We saw, first of all, the initial few months of the sell-off have been driven by this, like I said, the big surprise in rates, you know, because the contagion from the pandemic, which caused all the prices to spike, and then the surprise invasion of the Ukraine on top of that really caused this boom in inflation, which central banks then dramatically responded to, thinking they were going to have rates really low for a long time. The inflation spike freaked everyone out, so they went to really hike up rates. And so for the first part of this bear market, the sell-off was driven by this dramatic increase in interest rates, which competes for funds, so that, you know, suddenly you can get 4% on guaranteed instruments like GICs and bonds, and that takes money away from the really high-risk stuff. So that's the first leg of it. But the next leg of it is the fact that, so prices come down somewhat, but analysts were still predicting very strong earnings growth for most companies, for the large public companies, as they looked over the next year. And that is always the last thing. Because they tend to be long always or working for the sell side, they tend to be overly optimistic and always projecting very strong earnings growth. Even when you've come off of record earnings growth, you know, a double-digit pace, and there's obviously a cycle to earnings. It's not like a constantly rising stream. It's always been a cycle. And so when you get peak earnings, you do have to come into a period where earnings come down, and that's being, you know, magnified this time, as I say, by all this currency moves on top of the slump in global demand elsewhere. So long story short, what we're starting to see now, just in the last week, is analysts cutting their earnings forecasts, their forward-looking earnings forecasts. And that's always something that happens, you know, sort of midway through the bear market, where then people say, oh, well, we thought the price to earnings, for example, the PE, we thought it was, you know, 25, and we thought that that was relatively better than 30 when it was at the peak. But now if you're going to take a slash to the E and they're going to come off significantly, which is typical to see a 30 or 40% decline in the earnings number when you come into recessionary periods, then all of a sudden the PE or the valuation for the stocks are much higher than people thought, and the value is not nearly as good as many were, you know, maintaining. And so that's when you usually get the next big leg down in terms of repricing, because not only is every dollar of earnings worth less when interest rates are higher, as you look forward, the discounting factor means the earnings are worth less in present terms, but it also means that you're going to see this big drop in the E altogether, which means that price will also start to follow that lower. So I think that's the catalyst for the next phase of this bear market. And, you know, we may be already seeing that rollover. I don't know. We'll have to give this a few more days to see how much strength there is left in the rally that started, in sort of mid-June. But at some point here, I expect that we're going to get more of that repricing and recognition of these negative factors.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Counsel Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.